This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الحمد لله وبه نستعين والصلاة والسلام على سيد المرسلين وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. Thanks very much for the introduction and for the prayers and good wishes. And I didn't know I was unpopular in some circles. I'm just joking. I think that was probably my destiny, to be unpopular in many circles, which is not a problem. Okay, so they gave me, I love the topic they gave me because it was so enormous that it forced me to do a lot of work, which is good. These talks make me, you know, get off my self and do some research. Go over here, I think, on this one side. It's easier to do these things, not because I'm, you know, I don't agree with sort of PowerPoint culture, that everything has to have a PowerPoint, but when you're dealing with things that have technical terms, and it's sometimes easier if people can see instead of trying to hear, you know, odd words or odd names pronounced. So I also wanted to say that I really love traveling and meeting people in different mosque communities because it always makes me very optimistic. I think it's really... It's not normal to wake up every day and have just see people on TV saying how much they hate you and how much they want you out of their country. That's not a normal way to live. I've decided that's not normal. I've decided it's stressful. So it's okay to feel stress, recognize that. But even though things seem very difficult, and they are difficult for the Muslim community here and around the world, I'm very optimistic because when I meet especially young Muslims, I'm so impressed by them. Really, really impressed by them. And I'm also very impressed by the older Muslims. People love to make fun of the uncles and the aunties and how they didn't understand this country, the mosques. I don't feel comfortable in the mosques. This is really, I don't think people say that. I don't think really go to mosques. I really don't think they actually go to mosques. I meet uncles and aunties. They might have accents, but they understand this country much better than I do. And they built institutions in this country. They built the institutions in this country that provide the infrastructure for being Muslim. And the more I travel, the more I appreciate that. So, you know, here's to the uncles and aunties out there who don't get enough respect. Even though they may get their ships brought to them occasionally. Okay. So today's talk is about custom. And this is, I want you to think broadly first about this. There are certain societies, certain civilizations, certain views of law that say that people don't need any values to come from above or from revelation or from eternal sources. That in fact, all you need to govern yourself, all you need to tell you what's right and what's wrong is just your local culture. So for example, ancient Greece. What was right and what was wrong is basically what people in the city of Athens believed, or in the city of Sparta believed. It was that was the only source of right and wrong. So it's actually Muslims and Christians and Jews are different, at least historically, because they believe that human beings on their own are not able to come up with all the answers about what is right and what is wrong. That the human being is too weak, too feeble mentally, spiritually, to know what is right and what's wrong on their own. That they need reminders, they need direction from above, from God, and that comes through revelation. Now, as we'll see, that doesn't mean that local custom is irrelevant. It's very important. But it fills in the spaces, it contours the edges, it doesn't provide the skeleton, doesn't provide the framework. That comes from revelation. So what happened in beginning, let's just pick a date, around 1700, first in England, and then it moved into Western Europe, and then into Central Europe, then into the colonies of England, the United States, and other places, and then the whole world. What happened was something called modernity. Modernity. This was a transformation of human society in the social, political, religious, economic, technological spheres. Complete transformation of human society. Before In the year 2000, around the year 2000, over 50% of human beings lived in cities. At the year 2000, we hit the 50% mark. That is the biggest change in human history since human beings settled down, stopped wandering around and gathering nuts and berries and stuff like that, and decided to do agriculture. That's the biggest change. So human society has, since the 1700s, undergone changes that are before the last biggest change was settling down and not being hunter-gatherers. That was the biggest change. Now, what happened is that as society changed so rapidly, remember, people living, let's say, from around 1850 to 1950, they experienced change in every year that people 100 years earlier, 200 years earlier, wouldn't experience in their whole lifetime. What happened was society changed so much that many people, not all, maybe not even the majority, but many people believed that these transcendental rules that had come from Revelation were simply no longer applicable to human society. Human society had moved beyond these rules. And now the only source, even people who had previously been committed to Revelation, like many Christians and many Jews, not all, but many, they believe now that human custom, our custom, what we believe is right and wrong in our community, these are, in fact, the only sources of law that we need, the only sources of morality that we need. Now, they enshrine these values in almost pseudo-religious notions like human rights. So, for example, you don't want to be at a dinner party or a cocktail party and say, I don't care about human rights. You do that, you're not going to be popular. Because that's a new sort of source of absolute values, is human rights. You don't want to be coming out against human rights. But human rights are something that human beings created in the 20th century, in effect. They had their antecedents before that, but in effect in the 20th century. What I'm trying to say is that for most people living in the West today, I would say most, our customs are the only source of morality for us. If we decide that gay marriage is fine, gay marriage is fine. If we decide 10 years later that gay marriage is not fine, gay marriage is not fine. If we decide that incest is fine in 20 years, incest will be fine. There's no controlling, external control on this. And I don't want to say, just assume that that's bad. I mean, I think that's bad as a Muslim. But I mean, I'm not trying to judge here. I'm just trying to lay out the setting for this discussion. Okay. How much longer till we have to stop? 5 minutes. Okay. So, I forgot my piece of paper in my bag. I'll try and do it from memory. So, what is urf and ada? These are two important terms in Islamic law. Now that I've given myself the challenge, I'm still going to try and do this from memory. But I have the backup. Okay. These are two important terms. Sometimes from Muslim scholars will use them interchangeably, but they're very different in their basic meanings. Okay, we read the Quran all the time, and the Quran talks about al-amr bil ma'roof, do something bil ma'roof, right? For example, for marriage and divorce, the Quran says imsakun bil ma'roof aw tasrihun bil ihsan. Either talking to men. There's several different kinds of ways to end a marriage in Islam. There's talaq, which the man does. There's khula, which the woman does. There's tafriq, which the judge does. Which, by the way, is the best way if you want to minimize your divorce payments of either party. Do tafriq. That's my analysis. Get the judge to do it. But what does the Quran say? For men, if men are going to divorce their wives through talaq, it says either keep your wives by what's ma'roof, or send them away bi-ihsan, in a goodly way, with goodly conduct, or with good intentions. What is this ma'roof? What does ma'roof mean? Ma'roof comes from the root urf, or arafa, which means to know something. Something is known. Something is known. And if any of you are so bad that you watch Game of Thrones, which is really, really bad TV show, because it... But in the first season, I heard, there's this people called the Dothraki, and they're always saying, it is known. They'll say, it is known. That's the way they say this is, that's exact same meaning in Arabic. Something is known, it means it's right. What we know to be true is what is correct. What we know to be right is what is correct. So, urf is what the custom of a people is. And what is ma'ruf is what is defined by that urf, and it is what is known to be correct. And so, it's a very interesting concept because it's almost, by definition, relative in a sense. So the famous 9th century grammarian, Az-Zajjaj, says, ma'ruf is ma ustuhsina min al-af'al. It is what is considered to be goodly from actions. What actions are considered to be goodly? And in another, the famous tafsir scholar and jurist Al-Qurtubi from the 13th century of the Common Era, he said that he defined ma'ruf as ma'urifa annahu al-haq. What is known that it is truth. What is known that it is correct. And in another verse, in another discussion, he says it's tawfiyat al-haquq. It is giving people, making sure that people get their rights. So what is ma'ruf, what is known to be correct, is what is the truth and what guarantees that people get their rights. So this is the concept of urf. It's custom, and is what custom deems to be correct. Now, as I said, this is kind of, what custom? Is it the custom of the people of Boston? Is it the custom of the people of Medina? It depends. And this is where there's ambiguity in this issue. And we'll just discuss that more. The second thing is what's called ada. Ada means what's normal or what happens normally. So when you go to people in Egypt and you say, how have you been doing this last week or something? Say, adi, normal, things are going normal. Ada is, it's what you're used to. It's a normal course of affairs. Now, this is very important in Islamic law and in Islamic theology, because Muslims believe in miracles. So God could, if God wanted, God is all powerful. If God wanted, God could turn me into, right now, could turn me into a turkey, a talking turkey that would give a lesson. This is entirely possible. God could make, you know, my student coming to class, God could take that student, transport him to Mecca so that he could do his prayers in Mecca, and then return him 5 minutes late to my class. And that's entirely possible. As a Muslim, I believe that's entirely possible. It's possible, but it's not ada. And when it comes to law, and when it comes to our obligations to one another, we go by ada, not by what is rationally possible. This is a very important point. So, for example, this is one famous scholar, Egyptian scholar named Al-Bujairimi, who died in the early 1800s. He's discussing, what if someone says, I'm going to divorce, says to his wife, I will divorce you the next time you have your period. And then she never gets her period again, even though she's only 20 years old. What would happen? That is possible. It's medically possible, maybe. It's God could prevent this woman from ever having her period again. But in this case, he says, you go what's ada. You go by what's generally happens. What are the general rules of nature? What are the general rules of society? Because, he says, Bujairimi says, if someone, it's not possible by ada that a woman just stops having her period. It could happen. But it's not ada. And in law, we go by ada. By the way, this might sound weird, but this is exactly how American law works. You could say, you know, I know that I know the IRS sent me 10 letters, and I know that they called my house 100 times. All those letters got lost, and somehow the answering machine deleted every single one of those messages. I'd never heard this. It's possible, But it's not ada. And ada is what the judge is going to, or what the IRS official is going to rule by. So this is actually very common in legal systems. You can't always take exceptional situations. You have to go by what generally happens. I know. But 1 second. Let me finish this slide, and then we'll finish. So this is the important difference between urf and ada. They both have an impact on Islamic law, Islamic ethics. But ada is much more about the relationship that people have to God's power. God's all-powerful. Yes, it's possible that God could, let's say, another example is, let's say somebody dies and they come back to life. Does that person get all their property back, even after their inheritance has been given away? Do they get remarried to their wife, even though that marriage is ended when the person dies? It's possible that God can resurrect the dead, but it's not ada. And in law, you go with ada. You don't go with what those extreme situations that are technically, rationally possible, but don't really actually happen. Okay, so after this, we're going to talk about the big issue, which everyone thinks about when they talk about urf, which is the Sharia really always says this, but we're not going to do this because of urf. So urf as a way of getting out of what would normally be the law. Because this is really how people talk about urf today. They say, you know, normally Muslims, these are the rules we follow, but because that's not the way people live here, we're going to change the law. We're going to talk about when that's possible, under what circumstances it's possible, and when it's abused. I think it's also important to, I want to note something, which is that there's nothing more powerful in our lives. I mean, not in terms of, obviously God is the most powerful, but in terms of forces in our everyday life, there's nothing more that we feel to be more powerful than culture. People tend to poo-poo culture, but this is a famous Greek poet in the 5th century BC, a poet named Pindar. He said a very beautiful verse of poetry. He said, "Custom is the king of all. Custom is the king of everything." And always, I want you to keep this example in mind. If I brought you a plate of dog meat, would you eat it? No. In fact, you'd probably throw up. If you brought any American a plate of dog meat, they'd probably throw up. If you go to countries like China, they serve dog meat in restaurants. So something that even you feel is so disgusting that it must be morally wrong because you feel it so deeply in your soul. It must be morally wrong. There's another human being who's just as smart as you, just as moral as you on the other side of the world. He thinks there's absolutely nothing wrong with eating that. So those things, even those things that we think are the most disgusting and most unacceptable things, other people, for very good reasons, have no problem with them. So even deep disgust is actually culturally conditioned. It is culturally conditioned. That's very important thing to keep in mind. Because a lot of times, you know, you'll hear people say, "That's just horrible. I don't even need to describe how horrible it is. I don't even need to justify why I think that." Just because someone feels something is wrong, doesn't mean it's wrong. That's not evidence. That's not proof. It might just be the way their culture thinks of something. That's an important thing to keep in mind. Custom is extreme. And what are the kuffar in Mecca, the unbelievers in Mecca, what do they say to the Prophet over and over again? "We didn't find our forefathers doing this. This is not what our culture says." That was their main defense. "This is not the way we do things here." Why do Americans wear shoes inside? It's such a stupid, it's really a stupid way to live, right? You go outside, you walk in dirt, you walk in dog poop, and you walk into your house. It doesn't make any sense. You have to pay for carpet cleaning so often. It's much more reasonable to not wear your shoes inside. But people are attached to this. This is the way they do things. And they don't like people telling them to change their... People don't like being told to change the way they do things. It's a very important principle. Culture is extremely powerful. Okay. So, I mentioned before that when we talk about urf, I think this is one of those times when it's really useful to just get down to brass tacks. What are we really talking about? If you're a Muslim who likes to talk about issues of Islam and the Sharia, you've all had this discussion. Here's the way the discussion goes. Yes, the Sharia generally says X, or yes, this is usually haram, and yes, this is usually required, but we're not going to do that, or we are going to do this because of our urf, because our urf changes things. Is that a valid explanation? The answer is sometimes, and sometimes not. It's a very complicated, the role of urf in how Muslims decide what is right and wrong, what is pleasing or displeasing to God, is very complicated. So I'll try and my best, according to how I understand it, to explain it. Okay, so urf is, in effect, it shapes, I think this is a very important, I think it's useful. It shapes the contact surfaces of the law. And here the law, I mean the Sharia. It shapes the contact surfaces. So the Sharia has principles, it has general rules, but where those general rules turn into details, where those general rules come into impact with our lives, where those details shape our everyday interactions, that's where urf comes, and it shapes those contact surfaces to make the law fit into our lives, into our time, into our place. It doesn't mean you abandon those principles. It means it's actually, urf allows those principles to rest comfortably in a society. And here we always have to remember that there's two types of rulings in Islamic law. Two categories. One is the thawabit, things that don't change. Alcohol is haram. It's always going to be haram. Unless you're dying of thirst in the middle of the desert and you come across a six-pack of beer, then you can drink it. And then there's even debate about how much you can drink. Can you just drink enough to survive, or can you drink the whole six-pack? I'm not sure. Right? But it's still haram. I mean, alcohol is still haram. This is just a necessity. So there's no, it doesn't matter if you're on college campus where every night, every single person goes out and gets drunk until they can't see. That doesn't matter. It's still haram. Even if everyone in the society every night drinks alcohol with their meal, it's still haram. These things don't change. Certain things do change. A lot of the laws of marriage, what a husband owes his wife, what a wife owes her husband, what their jobs are in the house, these are almost all shaped by urf. How much mahr you pay. This all shaped by urf. And it's very interesting that something being from the thawabit or from the mutaghayyirat are the ones that don't change, the second category, I think I actually forgot to mention that. So the thawabit, which are the rulings that never change, and then the mutaghayyirat, the rulings that do change. Sometimes you find, for example, things that are from the thawabit, but might not even be clearly mentioned in the Quran. So for example, a man cannot have more than four wives. Does anyone disagree with that? No. Okay. The Prophet, alayhi salam, had more than four wives. But as far as I know, there's no Quranic verse that says the Prophet can have more than four wives, but no one else can. This is actually unstated explicitly, but everybody knew it. And Muslim scholars have known it since the very beginning, and no one ever questioned it. So it's not really explicitly stated, but it's so clearly understood that it has never been questioned. This is never something that can change. There's never a situation in which it's halal for a man to have more than four wives, except for the Prophet ﷺ. There's other things that are mentioned in the Quran very clearly that might be mutaghayyirat. So for example, the different types of people who are eligible to get zakat. There's eight different groups. And one of those groups is, the Quran mentions, al-mu'allafa qulubuhum. Those people who, originally it's the Meccan elite, the elite of Mecca and of Ta'if, they convert to Islam, even though they lost all their money, all their property, and the Prophet ﷺ gave them back from the spoils of war, from the zakat money, to make them loyal Muslims. And in fact, people like Muawiyah, Amr ibn al-As, very loyal Muslims after that. It was a very smart, strategic decision. For example, in the Hanafi school of law, that category doesn't exist anymore. The Hanafis say, this only applied to the time of the Prophet. After that, there's no more people who are
who can be mu'allafa qulubuhum. So even though it's stated in the Quran, the Hanafi school said, no, this category, it was only during the time of the Prophet. The other schools of law say, no, this category still exists today. So, for example, I've been teaching this class on Islam in Southeast Asia, so I've been reading all about Malaysia and Indonesia. But in Malaysia, when a Muslim says, I don't like being Muslim anymore, I want to leave Islam, oftentimes the government or an organization will help them out financially to try and ease their situation, because maybe they're actually suffering socially or economically, and giving them help with a business or something will actually ease their heart. So this category still exists for all the other schools except for the Hanafi school. It still exists. So sometimes, just because something's mentioned in the Quran doesn't necessarily mean it's from the Thawabit. Or just because something's not mentioned explicitly doesn't necessarily mean it's from the Mutaghayirat. It might be a permanent ruling. But let's look at how order functions as a license. Here I mean a license means something that is going to change the ruling of the Sharia ruling, or shape the Sharia ruling. So I wanted to make these things appear and disappear with buttons, but I didn't have enough time. Because I have two kids, I call them, you're not going to have enough time, and you better stay up late tonight, because that's what I have to do in order to get anything done, and I failed to do that, so sorry, I'll just have to point at them with the cursor. Right? Sometimes the Quran or the Sunnah of the Prophet in his hadith, alayhi salam, you actually have direct commands to do what is ma'ruf. So for example, as I mentioned before, in marriage and divorce, imsakun bil ma'ruf aw tasrihan bil ihsan. Either keep your wife according to what's ma'ruf or divorce your wife in a goodly way. This is the command to men. Women have their own rules for dealing with divorce. But we'll just stick with men because it uses the word ma'ruf. This means, actually, that most of the details of marriage and divorce are going to come from what is ma'ruf in a specific time and a specific place. So in America, for example, we might say that wives expect their husbands to help out with dishes, to be cook some of the time, to clean up, right, to help out with kids. There might be other societies where that's not expected of men. American husbands might expect their wives to do A, B, do this, do that, and the other. And other societies might not have these expectations. So a couple in America might end up getting divorced because they're not living up to their expectations of each other. And these are that's entirely justified. That's entirely justified in Islam, because a lot of these expectations are, we're told, we're supposed to follow what is ma'ruf in our time, in our place. Things like mahr, the amount of your mahr you pay. When you pay your mahr. Originally, Muslims didn't do this thing where they paid a little bit up front and then a lot if you divorce your wife. You paid everything up front. This mu'akhar mahr only started in the couple of centuries after the time of the Prophet, as far as I know, from the evidence I've seen. And then it became very common. And now, you have relatively small upfront mahr and big back-end mahr to prevent you from just divorcing your wife without any concern for your financial well-being, right? So these things are all allowed because these are based on our culture. Now, notice I have my arrows there. Just because God tells us and the Prophet tells us to follow what's ma'ruf doesn't mean you're allowed to follow what's ma'ruf, even though it contradicts clear evidence from the Quran and the Sunnah. It can't contradict those thawabit, those unchanging rules. So for example, it's ma'ruf to drink alcohol in the United States. But that can never make it okay for Muslims to drink alcohol in the United States. It's ma'ruf for, let's say it becomes ma'ruf for men and men to get married, or men and women to get married. And that's legal in the country. It's not, in my opinion, it can never be ma'ruf in Islamic law, in the Sharia, because in the Sharia, marriage has to be a contract between man and a woman, basically. Right? So just because you have changes in culture doesn't mean that those changes allow you to cross red lines, those thawabit, those unchanging rules of the Sharia. Then a lot of times you have in the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet implicit commands to do what's ma'ruf. To do what's ma'ruf. For example, our contracts with each other. The Quran says, O you who believe, ufu bil uhud. Fulfill your contracts. Fulfill your covenants that you make. This is a principle that the Quran sets up for us. Now, what type of contract we can have is really, in almost all the schools of law in Islam, is set by urf. Is set by urf. So, for example, if I go to the tailor and I say, I want you to tight, you know, make my, I'm getting fat, so I want you to loosen my pants. And he says, okay, that's fine. I generally understand, he's not going to charge me $1 million. If he comes back and he says, that was $1 million, I'm going to say, I'm not paying that, I'm sorry. He says, but I did what you asked. I said, yeah, I mean, we know this is not going to be that much money. If you go to a restaurant and you order a steak and the bill comes and it's $20,000, you don't have to pay that because he said, well, why didn't you look at the menu? You should have looked at the menu, buyer beware. No, in American law, that's not true. You can say, look, generally we know steak isn't going to be $20,000. But even if I didn't look at the menu. So a lot of, even in American law and in Sharia, what kind of things you can stipulate in a contract, the things you can expect, these things are dictated by urf. There's certain things that you can't do because you can't cross the red lines of the Sharia. So if I say, I will give you this money, provided you pay me back in a year with 20% interest. That's not allowed because you can't have interest-bearing transactions in Sharia. If you say, I want to buy this giant jug of alcohol, and in return I'll do this for you. You can't do that because you're not allowed to buy alcohol. These things, again, you can't cross red lines of the Sharia. Even things like, this is interesting, liability. I love reading these cases in Islamic law. It's very interesting. Like, let's say I'm a shop owner, and I say, I'm going to go pray. And I go and pray, and somebody comes and steals things from my store. Is the neighboring shop owner liable? In some places, it might be the custom that shop owners look out for each other's stuff. In that case, the other person might be liable for those things that were stolen. He was supposed to look out, or she was supposed to look out for that stuff. But in some places, it's like, hey, it's not my shop. It's your job to take care of this stuff. So this is, because I fly a lot, I have access to the lounge, the United Lounge, which, by the way, is more crowded than the normal airport. So a lot of times I just go into the regular part of the airport because it's easier. But I've noticed this in the lounge. People, they leave their stuff. The order of the business class lounge is you can leave your computer, you can leave your phone, doesn't matter. It's like some kind of order in there that people don't take each other's stuff. The regular part of the airport, I wouldn't do that. In fact, I don't do it in the business lounge either because I'm paranoid. Dress, even things like dress. So the aura, for example, what a men's aura is, their navel to their knees. This is known from the commands of the Prophet, his descriptions from the hadiths. But that means, in theory, I could come tonight and give this lecture wearing a really long pair of, you know, Bermuda shorts or something like that that happened to go up to my navel. Would you be okay with that? No? Okay, I'm kind of offended, but no, you wouldn't be okay with that because that would be ridiculous. But in theory, I'm not, hey, this is my, I'm covering my aura. Why are you complaining? I'm doing what's required of me in Islamic law. Because we have notions of propriety that go beyond what's your aura, just your aura. But that can change. So for example, you might be in a place where it's totally okay for men to walk around. I mean, again, go to Malaysia. In Malacca, in what's now peninsular Malaysia, and in Aceh, in the 1500s and the 1600s, after people had become Muslim there, the European travelers, the way they described the Muslims there, is the men would walk around, they have a sarong, right? So they have their kind of their calves to their navel covered, and they might have like a piece of cloth over their shoulders, but they were basically not wearing a shirt. And that was their urf. Their urf was covered, but other places like the United States, that would not be okay, unless you live in California, in which case, probably it's okay. So even things like dress, the details beyond what's required, beyond those laws that don't change, the details are shaped by urf. But you can't allow that to go outside the boundary of the Sharia. Now, this is the second type of function of urf. So we just looked at, sometimes the Quran and the Sunnah tells you, do what's ma'ruf. Or it gives you laws, it gives you principles like contracts, dress, and then the details and the additional material is filled in by urf. But another major function of urf is that it works with the principle in Islamic law, which is that ad-darar yuzal, or raf al-haraj. Darar yuzal means harm should be removed. Awal mashaqqa tajlibu taysir. Hardship or difficulty should bring ease to remove hardship. Or raf al-haraj, removal of hardship. These are principles that Muslim scholars follow. As much as possible, Muslim judges and muftis will try to remove hardship from people. And so a lot of times this is very strongly informed by urf, because urf gives you the actual functioning of society. What are the rules that people follow in society? What's expected of them? What are their customs? And how much can you work with the details of the Sharia to accommodate those customs? Because you don't want to cause people difficulty. You know, you don't want Muslims to have to walk around looking a way that's going to make them stand out so much people hate them or something like that. You don't want to have, you know, if you live in a society where wearing a white hat is extremely offensive, it's the most insulting thing you can do. Maybe in that society you shouldn't wear a white hat, you should wear another color hat, because why, you're causing these Muslims problems by putting them in danger in this situation. Okay, so what kind of actions can Muslim scholars as judges or as muftis take to accommodate urf? In level of, starting from the least serious or the lowest in degree, would be they can leave the mashhur. Now, people sometimes say, ooh, the Shafi'is say this, the Malikis say that, the Hanafis say this, the Hanbalis say that. Guess what? Your conversation is not complicated enough. Because Shafi'is don't just say one thing. Malikis don't just say one thing. In every school of law, on almost every issue, there's more than one opinion. So in that way, Islamic law, it's like American law, right? It depends what state you're in. Depends what jurisdiction you're in. The law in Boston might be different from the law in Delaware. It might be different from the law in Maryland. There's a lot of diversity in the Islamic legal tradition. A lot of diversity. Because Muslim scholars are always they're looking at the Quran, they're trying to understand, they're looking at the Hadith, they're trying to understand them, how they interact with the Quran, looking at the Sunnah of the Prophet. They might disagree about which Hadiths are authentic, which Hadiths are inauthentic. They might disagree on which Quranic verse is a general rule and which is a specific rule, which hadith is abrogated by which other hadith. Because there's so many steps in interpretation, you have a lot of tremendous diversity in the Islamic legal tradition. And as a scholarly saying goes, the ikhtilaf of the ummah is rahmah. The ikhtilaf of the ummah, the disagreement in the ummah is a source of mercy. Because what it means is that you can actually accommodate urf a lot of the time. So one thing you can do is you can leave the mashhur. This is in the Maliki school, in the Maliki school they call it the mashhur. In the Hanafi school they call it Zahir Riwayah. In the Shafi school they call it Mu'tamid. It's the main opinion of the school of law. So you can leave the main opinion and go to another opinion in the school of law if that's going to accord with the urf. So here I have examples from classical times, and here I have modern examples. But for example, face covering. Or looking at, should Muslim men look at women's faces? And again, seems weird in the United States because we're always looking at people's faces. But if you were living in, let's say, Bukhara in the 1000s, especially if you were a wealthy person, you would not, a man would not look at unrelated women's faces, and he would not want any man looking at his wife's or daughter's faces. But if you're in a society where it's normal for people to walk around with their faces uncovered, then the Zahir Riwayah opinion in the Hanafi school and the Shafi school is that women should cover their faces. But if that's not the order in that area, they'll go away from the main opinion of their school of law to another opinion which says it's not required. Something called istisna. Istisna means this is very important to us because we're always buying stuff online today. This is like factory ordering, making things to order. The general principle, as stated by the Prophet ﷺ in a hadith in Sunan of Abu Dawud, is لا تبع ما ليس عندك. Do not sell what you don't have. The general principle is you can't buy and sell things that don't exist. You can't buy and sell things that you don't have or the other person doesn't have. So if you order, let's say I order a shirt. You can order custom shirts online. I order that. And I pay with my credit card and it takes my money. That shirt doesn't exist yet. I should not, that's technically haram, according to the general principle. But because in our society, this is a known activity. For example, if I don't get the shirt that I like, I can get my money back. There's full accountability. No, the company is probably even going to give me the shirt for free. Right? We know that we can get our money back if we don't get what we want. This is part of our urf. So this becomes an exception to that general rule. And by the way, you can't just have things be exceptions just because you feel like it. When you see cases where there's a general rule, like don't sell what doesn't exist, don't buy and sell things that don't exist, the Prophet has already, alayhi salam, he already made an exception. So for example, the Prophet, alayhi salam, gave the permission for what's called bay al-araya. If you're really poor, farmer, you can sell your date harvest on your date trees even before they're ripe. Normally you couldn't do that because you're buying something that doesn't exist yet. You're selling something that doesn't exist yet. But you have to do this because I don't have any money until these dates are ripe. I can't feed my family until my dates are ripe. So I can sell people a portion of my date harvest now to survive. So this becomes an important exception. So you never, in my opinion, from what I've seen, you'll never find a situation where Muslim scholars will make an exception to a clear rule unless the Prophet ﷺ already made an exception and kind of opened that door, created a precedent for things like factory ordering. And another issue, having an imam that's paid, which is wonderful, right? In the Hanafi school, the Hanafi scholars, they came up with a rule, which is you can't get paid to do ibadah. This is in the Hanafi school. It's not a Quranic verse, or this is their principle in the Hanafi school they came up with. But they made exceptions for this based on urf, because in some places, you know, it was interesting. If you came to the U.S. in the 1980s probably, a lot of the mosques, there was no paid imam. The man was just so-and-so amu or uncle so-and-so, the guy who, you know, comes and gives the... But now there's more mosques, there's more Muslims. Muslims have questions about that normal uncles and aunties can't answer. So we need to have scholars that we pay. We need this to survive. So in the Hanafi school of law and all the other schools of law allow you to have someone who is paid to be the imam of the mosque, because otherwise Muslims would not survive as a community. Is part of their urf. Okay, just as an example of this today, in Southeast Asia and a country like Malaysia, everybody in Malaysia is Shafi, follows the Shafi school. The national law says Shafi school of law is the law for Muslims in this country. Their marriage, their divorce, their inheritance, waqf, everything is from the Shafi school of law. The Shafi school of law main opinion is women have to cover their face. But if you go to Malaysia, you will see very, very few women covering their face. Why? Because that's not the order for the people of Southeast Asia. That's not the urf. In fact, a lot of times you'll see women wearing hijab with short sleeve shirt. Very common to see this in Malaysia. And this is just, we'll get into that example later. But my point is, people don't cover their face there in general. And so they took the scholars in Malaysia, they moved away from the main opinion of the Shafi'i school, which says women have to cover their face, and they took the non-secondary opinion in the school. The second possibility, which is outside the madhab, Muslim urf can mean that scholars go outside their school of law that they normally work in. And especially if you're in a place like North Africa, everybody is Maliki. You go to Southeast Asia, everybody is Shafi. You go to Turkey or the Balkans, everybody is Hanafi. So this can sometimes be a big deal, because you're really going against the established school of law there. A good example of this is in the Hanafi school, the main rule was if there's a couple that's married, let's say the husband goes off on a trip as a merchant, he never comes back. What happens? The wife is sitting there. She needs, you know, is he dead? Can his estate be dispersed? Can I get remarried? How many years have to go by? The Hanafi school said, last thing we knew, he was alive. We were sure he was alive. Until we're sure he's dead, we assume he's alive. So they had to wait the normal lifespan of a human being in order for the marriage to be dissolved. That is, if you're living in a place, especially where there's a lot of travel, a lot of merchants going on sea voyages and getting in sea wrecks and things, or maybe they're just sick of you and they want to leave or something like that, that's not a good way to live. So in the Ottoman Empire, even though the Ottoman Empire was officially Hanafi, judges would say, well, we rule by the Shafi'i school. And the Shafi'i school of law, it's only 4 years. You only have to wait 4 years, and then the marriage can be declared over, and the woman can remarry. By the way, the same thing, well, I guess for a man, it would be not necessary, unless he has four wives already. This is very, I found this fascinating examples. Berber tribes in North Africa, in Morocco, what's now Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, they had customs that were very different from the Arabs in North Africa. So for example, if somebody got caught drinking alcohol, they'd burn his house down. It's pretty harsh, right? Or they'd fine the person. They'd ask them for a monetary fine. Actually, monetary fines are pretty rare in Islamic law. It's like the opposite of dealing with the IRS. Monetary fines are not the normal tool that Muslim scholars used, or Muslim judges used. But the Berbers used them a lot. And so what Muslim scholars in North Africa did is, it was hard enough just to get people to become Muslim. But they didn't really want to try to make them give up their culture entirely, especially when there's really strong customs. So they would say, even though the scholars in North Africa are all Maliki, they'd say, Ahmed ibn Hanbal, rahimahullah, he said that if there's a person who's been required to pay a certain amount of money, a large amount of money, but they refuse, they refuse to pay up, you can destroy that person's house as a punishment. It's the only, if someone's refusing to pay up. So they took that one opinion and they used that as the basis for justifying the Berber customs. So you can see here, going outside the madhab to this opinion of Ahmed ibn Hanbal. Oh, and the word alwah, the idea was these Berbers would write these on lawh, like boards. They called them alwah. The oldest one we know of is from the 1400s, early 1400s. Today, this has become extremely important. If you go to a country like, I think, Pakistan, if you go to Jordan, Egypt, many Muslim countries, you'll find a rule, which is that if you have, let's say somebody, like my father just died, okay? God rest his soul, my father died. Let's say I had died too. I have two children. The normal rule would be, in the other madhabs, except for the Hanbali madhab, that my children don't get any inheritance, because inheritance is like a river. It goes, it's a flow through people. So I'm no longer here, so my children are cut off. The inheritance would go to other people. The Hanbali school of law says, no, no, no. If you have orphan grandchildren, the person is required to leave them specifically a certain amount of money. There is the person whose will is being discussed has to leave specifically money or assets for those orphan grandchildren. So this is actually the rule, even in places that have nobody who follows the Hanbali school of law, we use this rule from the Hanbali school of law because it seems to be more just in our day and age. Farthest to the right, you can even go outside of all four madhhabs in Sunni Islam. This is pretty rare. It's pretty rare in the classical period. Someone who did this a lot was Ibn Taymiyyah, the famous scholar from Damascus, died 1328. Even he was a Hanbali scholar, but he was extremely creative. And sometimes he felt that the real message of Islam was best expressed by going back to sometimes even the opinions of the companions of the Prophet, radiallahu ta'ala anhum. So, for example, travel. In the Maliki school of law, Hanafi school of law, Shafi school of law, Hanbali school of law, they have very specific rules for how long. For example, I'm coming to Boston. In the Hanbali school of law, if I stay here for more than 21 prayers, I'm not traveling anymore. So if I stayed here for 4 or 5 days, I can't remember exactly what it is. If I stay for 2 weeks, not travel. If I stay for 5 days, I can't combine my prayers, I can't shorten my prayers. What Ibn Taymiyyah said is, Ibn Abbas, the companion of the Prophet, Ibn Abbas, his opinion was that you're traveling as long as you feel like you're traveling. So he really left it up to the individual, as long as they feel like they're traveling. Maybe I'm here in Boston for 5 days, but every day I'm moving from a different hotel. I have meetings all day. Sometimes I don't even have a place to put my bag. I'm walking around I'm here for 5 days. Beyond what the Hanbali school would say is the limit of travel, but I really feel like I'm traveling. So this is an example. He's going outside all the madhabs, and he's going to this opinion of the companion Ibn Abbas and taking his opinion. Also, Ibn Taymiyyah denied that if a man says, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you to his wife, he said this is not valid. You have to say this over 3 months, as the Quran states. And he goes to the opinion of Ibn Abbas as well on this issue. Even though all the madhhabs said that, no, if a man says, I divorce you, I divorce you, in one sitting, he's divorced from his wife. Ibn Taymiyyah said that's not the Quranic message. A good example of this today is handshaking, which is, I guess controversial. But nowadays, there's so many other controversies. Feels like it's not that controversial. But if you look at for example, the European Council of Fatwa and Research and Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, their opinion is that it's okay for men and women to shake hands as long as there's no risk of fitna. So if you're walking and if you're in a business meeting in America, you can shake hands with another man or woman. You're in a business meeting, there's no risk of fitna in this situation, right? They would allow that. Some people still say it's haram, because if you look at the schools of law in general, they'll say this is haram. It's haram for unrelated men and women to shake hands. Right? But here you have scholars like Yusuf al-Qaradawi going in general outside the madhhabs, even though in the Hanbali school, I think there's a minority opinion that you can shake hands if you're like a merchant or something like that, or you're a merchant, there's another woman who's selling pistachio nuts or something, and you have to shake hands about a big deal about pistachio nuts or something like that. That would be acceptable. But here they're really going back and looking again at kind of reinterpreting the hadiths on this and coming up with a law that goes outside the existing schools of law. Is everybody happy with those examples? How much more time? Okay, I'm going to end pretty soon. It ends at 9? Okay. Okay, I'll get through this quickly. Important things to keep in mind. Just because a scholar gives an opinion doesn't mean it's correct. Sometimes people, even classical Muslim scholars who weren't tempted by the West or weren't trying to get on CNN because they're a liberal imam or something like that, they could come up with rulings that were just wrong. For example, a scholar, Al-Hanafi scholar named Al-Kumari, who died in 991, Common Era, he's from Bukhara. He said that these workers who are loading bales of cotton and stuff like that, that their stomachs were always showing. The area between their navel and their pubic area was always showing. It was, their shirts were getting lifted up. He said, no, that's fine. It's not your, this is your urf, it's necessary, it's not awra. No, that's not. This is the awra is set by the from the hadith of the Prophet. We don't know where they have exceptions to this. So if people have to, yank up their sarong or yank up their pants a little bit. He was really criticized for this. A lot of times, actually, it's women who suffer. Nowadays, we think about urf as being this thing that's going to liberalize Sharia, liberalize Islamic law. But actually, historically, urf actually was something that oftentimes took away women's rights. So in North Africa, in the Middle Ages, it was a lot of times urf was used as an excuse for men to take over their wives' property. And say, in our society, the husbands really control their wives' property. Even though in Islamic law, the wife's property is her property. And then as a great example of this actually happened now in a court case in the United States, but I don't want to get into it because it'll make me too angry and it'll take too much time. Just because Muslims did something in the past doesn't mean it was right. Sometimes Muslims did things that was wrong, and there's nothing any Muslim scholar did could change that. And Sharif and I were talking about this on the phone. If you ever want a very interesting read, read The Travels of Ibn Battuta by a scholar named Ross Dunn. It's a great book, The Travels of Ibn Battuta. Famous Moroccan traveler traveled all over the Muslim world, outside the Muslim world, in the mid-1300s. And when he was actually a judge, he worked as a judge in the Maldives Islands in the Indian Ocean. And he tried his best to change customs that he thought considered bad urf. So for example, one custom was that if a man divorced his wife, or a woman left her husband, she had to live in her former husband's house until she remarried. That's kind of awkward, right? He said this is unacceptable, and he actually would have people fined or lashed if they did this. So he really tried to change this. Other things he couldn't change. The women went topless a lot of the time. He said the most he could do is if they came into his court, he made them wear something over their upper body. But he just couldn't change people's urf. In the Ottoman Empire, riba was common. It was so common, in fact, that Muslim scholars stopped trying to prevent it, and they just started trying to regulate it. So they wanted to make sure that you didn't have people being charged too much interest. They didn't want people getting charged usurious amounts of interest, like 11, 12% interest. So they set a limit, I think, at 11% interest, and they would try and make sure no one went above that because they just simply could not get rid of the actual practice of usury. So sometimes you just can't get rid of things. This is something that we have to think about today in America. Because urf in America is that men and women are participants in public life. Women participate in leadership. Women expect their voices to be heard as part of communities. Women expect to have facilities that are comfortable in the mosque. They expect to, these are fair expectations. But where does urf, where do the mutaghayyirat end and the thawabit begin? So, for example, we can say we want to make sure that women have a large space in the mosque where all the women who want to come to Jummah can pray. They can see the imam. They don't feel like they're shut off and that there's something shameful about them, right? But at the same time, does that mean that we're going to allow women to lead prayer, women to lead communal prayer? Does that mean we're going to allow men and women to pray side by side? Here you start coming up against the fact that in Islam, the default assumption in worship is that things are prohibited until you have evidence that they're allowed. And everything else, except for marriage, everything else like contracts, buying, selling, eating, whatever, the default assumption is something is allowed, it's halal, until it's proven that it's haram. In worship, it's haram until it's proven that it's halal by evidence from the Quran and the Sunnah. So we have to be very sensitive. Because we have to take into consideration urf, We also don't want to be, I hate to say it, maybe some of the first Muslims in history to really trample on those unchanging rules of how we worship. And so this is something that Muslim scholars and Muslim communities are debating today. And it's, I think, probably the best example of where we're dealing with the issue of urf, in at least in mosques and things like that.